Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Yes, I know, we're all saying it in chorus, and you're recording on Tuesday morning. So this is Black History Month. So I decided that I wanted to do something about lynching and what are lynchings. And then I found out about a book that I will tell you at the end of this little reading. What are lynchings? Historians broadly agree that lynchings were a method of social and racial control meant to terrorize Black Americans into submission and into an inferior racial caste position. They became widely practiced in the U.S. South from roughly 1877 to the end of the post-Civil War Reconstruction through 1950. A typical lynching would involve criminal accusations, often dubious, against a Black American, an arrest, and the assembly of a lynch mob intended on subverting the normal constitutional process. Victims would be seized and subjected to every imaginable manner of physical torment, and the torture usually ending with the person being hung from a tree and then set on fire. More often than not, victims would be dismembered, and mob members would take pieces of their flesh and bone as souvenirs. In a great many cases, the mobs were aided and abetted by, you got it, law enforcement. Indeed, they often were the same people. Officers would routinely leave a Black inmate's jail cell unguarded after rumors of a lynching began to circulate, just to allow for a mob to kill them before any trial or legal defense could take place. This was from a quote from The Guardian. And then a friend of mine sent me an article about a book that I've never heard of. It's entitled Without Sanctuary, Lynching Photography in America. And here's a quote by John Lewis. Many people today, despite the evidence, will not, don't want to believe that such atrocities happened in America not so very long ago. These photographs bear witness to that Holocaust. The Tuskegee Institute records the lynchings of 3,436 Blacks between 1882 and 1950. Many times a photographer was present to capture these events. There are almost 100 images reproduced here in this book. They are a testament to the camera's ability to make and remember what we often choose to forget. This statement could not be read in Florida, just to let you know. Joining us right now is a phenomenal reporter for Slate.com. The piece that he just wrote was entitled, Dobbs Was Always Just the Beginning. A single judge could outlaw the abortion pill nationwide, and that's not even the worst of it. So Mark, I read the article, I reread the article, I posted the article, and then I got angry, Mark. I got angry because I don't want to be the only one to cover this story. I want to see the story on MSNBC repeated as often as they repeat George frickin' Santos. Okay? I want to know as much about this judge. I want to know as much about this vulnerability. I want everyone to be outraged and terrified because this judge is the weak link. And now there is a rush to the bottom and the Supreme Court is going to accommodate that weak link. So thank you so much for writing this. And I am so frightened and so angry. But introduce my audience to the story of this judge, where he is located, the kind of decisions he has made, and why one judge could outlaw the abortion pill nationwide. And now most women are accessing the abortion pill and not necessarily having to get a physical abortion in order to terminate a pregnancy. So this could devastate us across all 50 states. Welcome to the program. And again, thank you.
Thank you, Arnie. Yeah, this story deserves so much more attention than it's receiving. This is a horrific story that I think in some ways was inevitable when Trump began stacking the federal courts with all of these far-right judges. He drew a lot of them from anti-LGBTQ, anti-abortion groups, including the First Liberty Institute, which is a kind of fringe far-right social conservative law firm that litigates against reproductive rights, against birth control, against IVF, against LGBTQ equality, against everything that progressives stand for. He is vehemently opposed to contraception. He says the sexual revolution was a horrible mistake. He doesn't think women should have autonomy. He doesn't believe that transgender people exist. He thinks they're just delusional. And all of that qualified him for the federal judiciary. His name is Matthew Kaczmarek, and that is a name to remember. Matthew Kaczmarek sits in the Amarillo Division of a federal court in Texas. And what's important to understand here is that he is the only judge who sits in that division. And so when conservative plaintiffs want to file a lawsuit and Republican politicians want to file a lawsuit, they file their case directly to him, to the Amarillo division, because they know that he will be the lone judge to hear it. That is gaming the system brazenly. It's not how the system is supposed to work. The vast majority of courts have multiple judges and cases are assigned at random to different judges. But here, because he's the only one, he is assured to get the case. And so in the past, and I could just talk about this all day, but this judge has issued horrible decisions blocking access to birth control for minors in Texas, holding that their parents have a constitutional right to deny them access to contraception, not even abortion, just basic birth control. This judge has defied the Supreme Court and held that employers have a right to discriminate against LGBTQ people, to fire gay people for being gay. He has ruled that doctors and healthcare providers have a right to discriminate against LGBTQ patients. He has seized control of border policy for more than a year. He ordered the Biden administration to re-implement a terrible Trump-era policy called Remain in Mexico that forced migrants to live in these tent cities on the southern side of the border. He actually oversaw diplomatic negotiations between U.S. officials and Mexican officials, because in order for that to work, Mexico had to agree to it. So he ordered diplomats to get on a plane to Mexico and work with them to allow these migrants to be stuck in Mexico at threat of court sanction. He is a maniac. He is a maniac judge. But what's terrifying is he sits in the Fifth Circuit, which is a maniac court of appeals. And of course, his decisions ultimately go to the Supreme Court, which is increasingly lawless and wild. And so when conservatives decided to go after abortion pills after the fall of Dobbs, where did they take their case? They took their case to the Amarillo division, where Matthew Kaczmarek sits. And they asked him for effectively a nationwide injunction in all 50 states that would outlaw medication abortion, that would make it criminal and illegal to take or prescribe medication abortion by judicial fiat. And he is, by all signals, taking this case extremely seriously and preparing to issue an order in the coming weeks or perhaps the coming months that will yank medication abortion from the market, that will make it criminal to possess or prescribe, and that will prohibit women in all 50 states, including the deepest blue jurisdictions, from using medication abortion as currently approved by the FDA. Okay, and the fact, Mark, that I'm the only one talking about this drives me nuts.
Well, it's making me nuts, okay? It's literally making me nuts. And again, a lot of people don't know a lot about what's happened in the abortion front. And again, you give us a little paragraph about a little bit of the history about how abortion has changed in America since Roe. And I think it's really important for people to understand what this means by denying access to this medication abortion in all 50 states. And I just want to read two or three sentences from your phenomenal article that everybody needs to freaking share at Slate.com. Let's be clear that the legal battle over medication abortion became inevitable at the moment Roe fell. Over the past 50 years, reproductive health care has undergone a dramatic shift. A majority of American patients now terminate their pregnancies with pills rather than by undergoing a procedure at a clinic. This makes good sense, as medication abortions are 18 times safer than childbirth, reliable and easy to access. In the 23 years since the FDA first approved the abortion pill, the agency has slowly loosened restrictions on prescriptions, although they still remain irrationally stringent. Meanwhile, a booming gray market for the medication has sprung up online, which has infuriated anti-abortion activists. So I want people to know that most of the abortions in America are by these forms of abortions. Please understand this. But the other point that you made, which was so important, this will impact all 50 states, whether you approve of Roe or not approve of Roe, whether you've actually, you know, that means if they can't get access to these drugs, they then have to go to a clinic to get an abortion. If you are already slammed by all the other people that are coming in from all the states that have denied abortion, you suddenly increase the number of people that need to access abortion. Guess what? everyone is at the back of the line. Everybody is seeing a long line, and people are going to be denied abortions, whether they're in a blue state or a red state, because they can't get in soon enough. This is the ripple effect of this decision is so freaking enormous that I think people need to understand it impacts you. It impacts every woman you know. And I think this is why it is just such a terrifying decision. But the other thing is, you almost left the biggest story, I think, at the door about this this judge from North Texas. Can you remind them about a recent decision he made about domestic violence abusers and their access to guns? This puts him in a place, I think, that is like almost in la-la land, but this is the kind of irrational, anti-female, misogynist, anti-abortion judge he is. He doesn't think rationally. He uses his power in ways that is so abusive, and yet it isn't just about the plaintiffs that are coming before him. It is about all of us.
Yeah, so it was not this particular judge who issued that ruling, but it was the Fifth Circuit that oversees him, that is going to hear this case regardless. And so it's like basically the same thing.
Okay, thank you.
And it's really important, I think, to remember that, you know, the reason guys like Kaczmarek are getting away with this is because they sit within the Fifth Circuit, and because these insane judges are hearing their cases when they're on appeal and encouraging this lawlessness and encouraging the craziness. So the Fifth Circuit very recently, in a unanimous opinion by a three-judge court, held that the Second Amendment protects your right to possess a firearm while you are under a restraining order for domestic violence, and threw out the conviction of a man who was under a restraining order for assaulting his ex-girlfriend, who was told you cannot go anywhere near your ex-girlfriend, you cannot have a gun, you are not permitted to be in the same vicinity as this person you assaulted. And he had a gun, in fact, two different guns in his home. He was convicted for it. And the Fifth Circuit said that violates his constitutional rights. You as an individual have a Second Amendment right to have a gun while you are under a civil protective order for committing this kind of domestic abuse. And what I think is so important to remember, and many people are not aware of this, a significant majority of mass shooters have domestic violence in their past. A significant majority of people who have committed mass shootings in the United States were accused of or convicted of domestic violence. Many of them were under restraining orders at some point for abusing their intimate partners. Domestic violence is the best indicator for whether someone will carry out a mass shooting. And the presence of a gun in the home renders the likelihood of domestic violence being lethal so much higher. If there is a gun in a home, domestic violence turns into murder. It turns into homicide. This is not just common sense. This is borne out by statistics. And yet now we have federal appeals courts saying that you as a domestic abuser have a right to own a weapon.
Mark, you don't know this, but about maybe 35 years ago, I was still married to my first husband, who was an attorney who represented many women involved in a domestic violence situation. And so he would get them out of the house. He would find them a safe home, yada, yada, yada. And one day the phone rings in our house, and I live right along the Connecticut River. My husband picks up the phone, and the gentleman on the other end of the phone is the domestic violence person, okay, the person who's, you know, on the opposite side of the case where my husband's protecting the wife. And he says to my husband, "Your wife is doing the dishes right now." And he said, "What do you mean?" He said, "How do you know that?" He said, "Because I have my gun sight on her."
Oh my God.
All right.
Oh my God.
Okay. And Tom is looking at me going, "Drop to the floor. Don't move. Drop to the floor." And I'm looking like, "What the frick are you talking about? Drop to the floor." I had no idea why he was telling me this. Because just what you just said, understand, he wasn't shooting his wife. He was out trying to threaten me.
Yep.
And I was now the target. Okay. As you were describing this, I am going back 35 years ago and remembering exactly that story, only it's happening in my life with my ex and in my kitchen. And he literally, I mean, he had a gun sight on me from the other side of the river or wherever he was. I can't even, but it doesn't matter. He knew what I was doing. He knew what I was doing and threatening my husband. All right. So you're absolutely right. And when I read that story about the domestic violence folks being handed their guns back, I'm going, what are you doing? But let's talk more about this judge. Okay. So this case, they forum shopped. It is not uncommon for people to forum shop. But the question then becomes, what do they have to hand to this judge that he could even make a decision in their favor? And you say there are three sort of hats that they may wear in order to get into this judge. And every time you look at one of the arguments they make, they're specious. There's nothing there. But I don't think that matters to that judge.
No, of course not. I mean, what they're arguing is that when the FDA approved medication abortion in the year 2000, 23 years ago, that it failed to properly consider the science, that it failed to weigh the medical effects of medication abortion, and that it is up to the courts to basically revoke the FDA's approval and criminalize medication abortion by judicial fiat. This has never happened with any drug before, ever, period. No judge, no federal court, no court, period, has ever ruled that the FDA must revoke approval of a drug, of a particular drug or medication or medical device because some plaintiffs just disagree with what the FDA scientist said. It's crazy to me because medication abortion is at least 18 times safer than childbirth. Medication abortion is an incredibly safe regimen. People do not die of medication abortion. People die from childbirth. And yet what these plaintiffs are arguing is that because there are some side effects for some patients with medication abortion, usually relatively mild, cramping, some clotting, they pass, it is not a big deal, but that those make medication abortion impermissible for the marketplace and that it should never have been approved in the first place. This comes 23 years too late. And these plaintiffs are simply doctors who have no standing to challenge the FDA's approval in the first place. Their argument for why they're affected is that one day a patient might take medication abortion in another state, because it's illegal in Texas right now, and that they will then have complications and they will then go to these doctors' offices. The doctors will have to treat their complications from a medication abortion that took place in another state, and that grants them an individualized concrete injury that lets them sue. No court has ever accepted a theory like that. It is absolutely absurd. It is beyond the pale. And what I fear is that this judge won't care, because the same thing happened when a dad went to this court and said, I don't want my teenage daughter to be able to access contraception. That should not have granted him standing. His daughter had no plans to access contraception. This was totally speculative. And yet the judge agreed and blocked minors from accessing contraception by themselves in Texas. And so this is the thing about, you know, following the rules in 2023 in the federal courts. There are no rules. There is no law. Nobody knows what the law is. After SB8, the Texas vigilante abortion ban, after Dobbs, after everything the Supreme Court has done, nobody knows what the law is, and it can change at any time. You can never go to bed at night knowing your rights will be secure when you wake up in the morning. And so even though the plaintiffs have no standing, even though the merits are totally bogus and based on fake science, even though no judge has ever claimed the power to remove a drug from the market single-handedly, I think there is a serious chance that this judge will ban medication abortion in the coming weeks. And I don't think that it's a sure thing that the Fifth Circuit or the Supreme Court will step in and overrule him.
Well, one of the other things that you said, which is so interesting, is that there's a paper that's about to come out. And in an upcoming paper on abortion pills by professors David Cohen, Greer Donnelly, and Rachel Robuche, the authors note that, quote, after more than 20 years on the U.S. market, mifepristone has become one of the most studied drugs available and is proven to have an impeccable safety profile, not only safer than common drugs like penicillin, but, boys and girls, safer than Viagra. Again, I mean, you're right. They're 23 years too late. I get it. Now we know after 23 years, there is no history of anything that they are fearing or suggesting. They're talking about a patient that they've never met because they don't have a patient to be able right. to prove that there's a case in controversy or that there's a problem here. So this is all fiction, 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 fiction. But as you pointed out, once the Dobbs decision came down, it was going to be like the Wild West. Mm-hmm. And anything that was possible was going to probably be filed. And anything that was going to be filed was going to be filed in where? North Texas. They even yeah. knew exactly where to go. And you also point out that, you know, when you looked at the players in this case, You were talking about the Alliance Defending Freedom. I just want people to hear this. The activists think they have a solution to the pill problem. Ban mifepristone, the first drug taken in the two-drug medication abortion protocol approved by the FDA, which ends the pregnancy. Rather than work through elected representatives or popular votes, they're attempting to do this via a lawsuit seeking a nationwide injunction. Now listen to this sentence, everyone. They're represented by the far-right Alliance Defending Freedom. Erin Morrow Hawley, wife of GOP Senator Josh Hawley, is a lead attorney. Oh my God. It's almost like you're watching them. They created a quilt. They knew exactly what the pieces were. And now after the Dobbs decision, all the pieces are being stitched together. It is methodical. It is evil. It is frightening on so many, so many levels. So I want everyone to know about this judge. I want to know that one judge could actually remove this option in all 50 states. I guess I got to ask the question. So knowing it, what do we get, Mark? What do we get? We can't turn to the Supreme Court for support because the Supreme Court is rubber stamping. I mean, I am just trying to figure out. I feel castrated. I really do. I feel emotionally and economically and socially and politically like abandoned as to how to respond. I know I'm in a state that at least for the moment currently protects the right to abortion, but we don't even have that on the books. We're the only state in New England that doesn't at this point in time, I believe. How do we arm ourselves to not only have this information at our fingertips, but what is the response?
So I think first of all, and I know this is a big ask, but if you are a woman of reproductive age and you live in a state where you can currently access the pills, get the pills so that you can give them to your friends and family when they need them. Wow. Stockpile the pill. I know this sounds extreme. I know this sounds drastic, but here in DC, for instance, it's very easy. You can order the pills to your door. There are a lot of sort of sliding scale fees for people who can't afford it. Get the pills now so that you can send them to people who need them in the future. That is the number one thing that individuals can do. The second thing is, and this is a little bit more complicated, but there is another drug that can induce abortions. So the medication abortion is two drugs, mifepristone and misoprostol. Mifepristone ends the pregnancy, misoprostol expels the pregnancy. In a lot of countries, misoprostol is used on its own. It's not as effective. Sometimes it requires a second dose, but it does expel the pregnancy, and it is prescribed for a bunch of stuff other than abortion. It is the gold standard stomach ulcer drug. It is prescribed to pets. You can get a prescription from PetSmart for your dog if your dog has stomach ulcers. Abortion providers who are listening to this need to be prepared. If this judge bans mifepristone, which is in the crosshairs and is the safest and most effective drug here, you know, it should be used with misoprostol, but if it's taken off the market, providers need to be ready to start prescribing misoprostol for patients by itself. There are guides online already for people in red states how to do this, how to order stomach ulcer drugs and use them for an abortion. It is not ideal. It is not as safe and effective on its own, but it is better than nothing. And because it is approved for other conditions than abortion, doctors in every state can still prescribe it. And I think, and I was just talking to an abortion provider in California about this earlier today, they are preparing to prescribe misoprostol off-label for abortion on its own if mifepristone is taken off the market. Not ideal, not the best case for patients, but it will do the trick. And that is unfortunately the only thing that patients and providers will be left with if this drug rules that mifepristone is illegal.
They're making us so unsafe. I just want to let you know, this is the party of death. This is the party of threats. This is the party that basically says that you should be vulnerable and stay vulnerable. And I'm going to ensure that vulnerability, whether it's giving your domestic violence abuser a gun or whether it's telling your doctor that they can't give you this drug that they know is safe and legal. It is just, but now they're making it illegal because of this one judge, because they did the forum shopping. It is so frightening what we are asking women to do. That's really what is so shocking. When you first said start stockpiling, I'm like, oh my God, that would be your first response was so shocking to me. But that tells you how terrifying it is. And I just want people to be aware, this is a story that must be shared. This is a story that they should make into a 10-minute documentary right now on MSNBC and CNN and ABC. Dobbs was always just the beginning. A single, let me remind everyone, a single judge could outlaw the abortion pill nationwide, and that's not even the worst of it. Again, his name, what is his name again? Matthew Kaczmarek.
Remember that name.
Matthew Kaczmarek, and when will this decision come down, do you think?
We don't know. Weeks, months, he might hold a hearing. He has indicated that he wants to hold a full-on trial about this case, which suggests that he does think the plaintiffs have standing and that their arguments do have merits. And that could happen in the coming weeks, and he could issue a decision anytime after that. So this is like a any day now you might wake up and learn that mifepristone, the abortion pill, has been banned in all 50 states.
His last paragraph, overturning Roe was not the terminal point in the decades-long journey to limit reproductive rights. It's even barely the start. Maybe this is the moment in which we ask ourselves why so many of us are still surprised, why we are still caught off guard when a court arms alleged domestic abusers or limits access to abortion, or stay tuned, criminalizes medication abortion everywhere. The crisis here is not just that a federal judge could imminently ban an abortion drug that's been used safely for 23 years. It's that the chaos wrought by Dobbs means anything is possible, and no one, not even in the deepest, bluest states, can go to bed with any certainty that they will wake up with their rights intact. That is the legacy of today's Supreme Court. No one can ever really know what new nightmares tomorrow will bring. Mark Joseph Stern is a powerful writer. This is a powerful story. It is an important story. Share it now. Thank you so much for doing this, Mr. Stern. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Arnie. Always a pleasure, even on dark days like this.
Yes, thank you. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
Let's talk pardons and the president.
I'm criminal defense attorney Luke Ryan, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
On December 30th, President Biden issued 6 pardons, one to a woman who was the victim of relentless physical abuse, but who at trial was prevented from introducing evidence of battered women's syndrome, and 5 to men who had committed federal drug offenses. All 6 completed their sentences decades ago, and all have lived long, productive, law-abiding lives. Some background. The Constitution grants the president the power to grant pardons, commutations, and reprieves. A pardon expunges the crime, as if it never happened. A commutation leaves a conviction in place but reduces the sentence. Commutations and pardons both come under the heading clemency. President Coolidge, for example, granted clemency some 1,700 times, FDR almost 4,000, Truman over 2,000. In contrast, the second President Bush, in his 2 terms, issued only 200, and the first President Bush, in his 1 term, 77. President Obama granted clemency over 1,900 times, mostly commutations to persons serving draconian sentences for nonviolent drug offenses. Hopefully, President Biden's recent pardons, including earlier pardons for marijuana offenses, indicate that going forward, this president will emulate President Obama's policy that combined compassion with common sense.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because, as the criminal legal system proves every day, freedom can't protect.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people, this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now. And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When
it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Tuesday morning. Still upset about that interview with Mark Stern. Now I get to be upset about Ron DeSantis in Florida. So, as you know, we do DeSantis Watch at least once or twice a month. We've been following Ron DeSantis. I keep saying, you know, has America ever elected a fascist? Well, we had a fascist in waiting with Donald Trump. We may have the fascist in pact with Ron DeSantis, but he is the governor of Florida. And with that, he has power and he also has opportunity. He had a very successful reelection campaign. And so therefore he has the wind in his sails. We've been learning a lot about his assault on public education, whether it's public education K through 12 or whether it's higher education. I started hearing about his assault on a small college in Florida known as New College. I started looking around and we started talking about it, and I saw this op-ed at the Herald Tribune, in the Sarasota Herald Tribune, and it was entitled Inside the New College Boardroom. An ungodly display of power and arrogance. I have to tell you, Carrie Seidman, that headline just grabbed me, ungodly display of power and arrogance. And I was like, I'm there. I'm going to read every single word of this. You used to be the lead columnist for the Sarasota Herald Tribune from 2010 to 2020. You left the paper and then returned in 2022 as a once-a-week opinion columnist. You have written for the Albuquerque Tribune. You also, I believe, wrote for the New York Times at one point in time. So you have a long history as a writer, and now you're sort of finishing off your career covering once a week, lucky you, the very changing face of Florida. Let's talk a little bit about New College. And as I mentioned to you, I was talking to my former campaign manager. I ran for governor in 1992, and I had a brilliant campaign manager. And we were talking the other day, and she's on vacation in Southern California. And I said, oh, we're going to cover the story of New College. She goes, what story? Because she's been sort of out of the loop for the last 4 or 5 days. I mean, what? I said, what do you mean, what story? So I started telling her about the assault on New College and changing of the board and changing the curriculum so that it would become the Hillsdale of the South. And she suddenly went, Arnie, my brother and sister went to New College. So I just want people to get a sense of this. If she worked on my campaign as my campaign manager, you know me as quite a liberal progressive candidate. Yeah. You can imagine what the history of New College is if her brother and sister went there. So I just want to give a little backstory and flavor to this story. Let's talk a little bit about what is New College and what happened just within the last week or so, because it really is doing a 180-degree change in what the college had a history of doing, what it was known for, the kind of students it encouraged to participate, and why DeSantis is using it to some extent as his poster child.
Well, thank you for inviting me on the show, Arnie. New College was founded in the early 60s. It was actually started as a private college, and it was started, interestingly and ironically enough, by a group of Christians here in Sarasota who wanted to create a college where critical thinking was foremost, free thinking, critical thinking, getting away from sort of rote academics and giving students an opportunity to really challenge themselves intellectually and develop themselves as leaders. And so they came up with this very interesting model that allows a lot of freedom to the student to sort of fashion their own field of interest and pursuit of, you know, their interests. And it has traditionally had no grading. There are narrative assessments of all the students' works. Students are encouraged from when they first come to New College to pursue independent study, to do research, And there's also, they also have an interesting sort of January in between semester period where they work on an independent study, often in conjunction with an organization or a business locally. So it's always been this kind of unusual model. Now it started, it had difficulty right from the beginning financially, and finally to the point where it was taken in by the Florida State University system and designated as the state system's honors college. Anyone can look up New College alumni. There have been many, many very learned and illustrious and successful alumni that have come from New College. However, in more recent years, it has struggled financially. It has struggled to keep its enrollment up. You know, the reasons for that depend on who you talk to. You know, if you talk to someone from Governor DeSantis's camp, it's because they have created a quote unquote woke culture that has become an echo chamber and that has ostracized students who don't share those progressive beliefs. If you talk to people at the college, they will tell you that the state has basically starved it of funding, and they have crumbling dormitories. They have many buildings on the campus that are not even online. And it's not a college that's ever probably going to appeal to the masses. It has traditionally been known kind of as that quirky school where all the brainy people go. You know, and
I'm going to stop you, Carrie. I'm going to stop you for a second. I'm smiling. So I graduated from St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Yeah, sure, you betcha, in 1975. But you were describing something that St. Olaf recognized was something that they wanted to encourage. And within this private Lutheran school, we had something called Paracollege. And Paracollege is almost identical to New College. Identical. I mean, you know, you created your own coursework. You didn't have grades. We had the 414 system, so that January was a place where you could be incredibly creative and work with someone or create your own program. In fact, I am just smiling because I am going to a 70th birthday party with a friend of mine who went to St. Olaf. And you know what I did in my 414, my last year? I produced the play JB by Archibald MacLeish, which is about the book of Job, where it isn't that Job needs God, but God needs Job. So what does that tell you? I'm just laughing because as you're describing New College, I'm screaming Paracollege, St. Olaf, whatever. And it's not that, it's one vehicle for the way some people learn and some people excel. We all know that we should all have our own individual IEP. Well, guess what? That's actually true for college as well. And New College offered a lot of really bright, sort of creative students an opportunity to learn in a non-traditional way, but actually be wildly successful in America in a very traditional way. But they got to goal in the way they could. But obviously, if you don't want that, if you question anyone who wants to use critical thinking, if you want this, whatever this classical education means to Ron DeSantis, then the school that you want to sort of make sure you change or destroy or devolve is going to be this institution. And you point out it does have some weaknesses going in. So you can point to those weaknesses, not actually acknowledge the fact that you're responsible for some of those weaknesses because you've starved the institution. Therefore, the institution is failing.
New College has been struggling financially for a while. And there was a point, I can't remember how long, a year or two ago, where it actually, there was discussion of absorbing it into another college within the state system. That was about 2 years ago. 19 months ago, they hired a new president. And, you know, her top priority was increasing enrollment, increasing retention of students. That was President Auker. The president who was fired at this most recent board meeting. So just to catch everyone up, that's a little history of New College itself. What happened at the in January was that Governor DeSantis appointed six new trustees to the New College board, all of them with very conservative, mostly Christian backgrounds, some of them known for their activism in certain areas. For example, Mr. Rufo, who you mentioned, who is with the Manhattan Institute, who has been a so-called expert on the eradication of critical race theory. There is selection of new trustees. One of them is the founder of a Christian academy, lower school academy nearby here in Sarasota. And then there was a seventh appointment to the board from the Florida Board of Governors, which is also pretty much controlled by Governor DeSantis. And that was another Christian conservative, which made the majority of the board cohesive as they now had the power on the board. Mr. Rufo and Eddie Speer, who's the gentleman from Bradenton nearby here, who has the Christian Academy called Inspiration Academy, they came to the school 2 weeks ago because as soon as these appointments were made, as you can imagine, the students, the parents, the alumni, the faculty, everybody was totally freaked out. What, you know, what does this mean? What's going to happen? As you said, there were all kinds of references that they wanted to make New College the Hillsdale College of the South. And for those who don't know, Hillsdale is a Christian private school in Michigan that does not accept any government funding, largely so that they don't have to comply with government regulations about diversity and so forth.
Let me just stop you there. Hillsdale is Betsy DeVos's pet project. Let me repeat this. It's Betsy DeVos's pet project. Her brother went to Hillsdale. It's through Hillsdale that they're basically disseminating all the information on how to basically gut public education, how to create this voucher system around the country. They are what I think Ron DeSantis would look at Hillsdale and say, that's exactly what I want to replicate. They have what he calls classical education. And I just want people to know, you now have to start worrying about the term classical, because what does classical mean? It means basically it's rote. You don't think, you don't challenge all these, you know, issues that would be probably expected for you to study would be drained out of the system. So again, it's Betsy DeVos's pet project is Hillsdale. I think that's almost the best code to be able to describe it, because people go, DeVos? Oh no. And that's exactly what he wants to do. Okay, keep going, Carrie. I apologize.
Here's a little known sidelight. I went to elementary school with Betsy DeVos's husband and have known the DeVos family my whole life.
Oh my God.
Yes, I'm quite intimately familiar with the family. Okay, so Rufo and Speer, these two new trustees, came in prior to the first board meeting. I'm not even sure they had been sworn in yet as board members, and they met with the student and faculty. And there were all kinds of assurances from them that they were there to listen, that they were there to hear the diversity of voices, that yes, there were changes that need to be made, and they were there to save New College and make it a more inclusive place. Well, then the entire board came in and assembled for their first meeting last week. The board agenda was released the day before the meeting, and on the agenda were a discussion of the employment of the president, Dr. Ocher, the employment or the retention of the board chair, Mary Ruiz, and the retention of the legal counsel for the board. They came in. It was well attended by media from all over the country. There were about 100 to 150 students and parents and alumni who were allowed into the actual boardroom, who were each given 60 seconds to speak. And the board members sort of, this is my perspective. I was there in the media gallery, and the board members, you know, respectfully tolerated the comments of the students and parents, many of very impassioned, many of them in tears, many of them students who said that they had never found a home that they felt safe in until they came to New College. And then they proceeded to terminate the president, who had increased enrollment by 30% during her 19-month reign.
Oh, God.
The board chairman resigned before she was terminated. The legal counsel resigned. Just as I was sitting in the meeting right prior to it starting, my phone alerts went off, and I looked, and on my phone it said that the Tampa Bay Times was reporting that Richard Corcoran, who used to be DeSantis's education department chair, was going to be named the new president. And indeed, after they had announced President Acker's termination, they made a motion to enter into negotiations with Richard Corcoran to become the new president of New College. And the other thing that happened at the meeting, and this is really important, is that Christopher Rufo moved to eliminate the all diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at the college.
But my understanding is that he decided to eliminate them at New College, but Ron DeSantis wants to eliminate them at all the public universities in Florida. So again, I just want everyone to know, look at New College, follow New College, look at the change, look at what they're doing dramatically. This is maybe the most extreme because it was the most quirky of the schools within the system. But whatever they are doing there, it is not going to stop at New College because, as you mentioned, Chris Rufo decided to get rid of the equity and whatever diversity program at New College. And then I just read just this week, 2 days ago, a day ago, that that's exactly what Ron DeSantis wants to do with all the universities in the system, get rid of these things. And I just want to remind everyone that that includes, when you're talking about equity and diversity, you're talking about, for example, children who are handicapped. You're talking about diversity isn't just black and white.
The reason his motion didn't pass, although it basically was just moved to, you know, we will investigate that, is that it was pointed out to them that that office doesn't, and it's called the Office of Inclusion and Excellence at New College. It isn't just affirmative action initiatives. It is assistance to first generation college goers. It is assistance to veteran students. It's assistance to students with disabilities. It's assistance to students who have special dietary requirements. It's a whole lot of things besides what they painted as.
And so Rufo was not able to pass it at New College, but now it's being moved up the food chain, and now DeSantis is offering it statewide.
A couple of days ago, the governor announced that was going to be the effort throughout the state colleges. You know, that kind of puts it on a collision course, because at some point, if they eliminate all those programs at the Florida state colleges, at some point, some of those things are going to be in conflict with federal law regarding diversity and inclusion. So as we've seen time and again, DeSantis doesn't seem to think throwing everything into the courts is a problem. He's did the same thing with his parental rights in education law, did the same thing with the Stop Woke law that he passed. These are all laws having to do with what is taught in schools and what texts are permitted and, you know, what is taught about race and gender and so forth. So at some point, that's going to put Florida schools at a distinct disadvantage, if not thickly into the courts, because, you know, there are already lawsuits happening because of those.
But Carrie, you and I think that that's a problem. Ron DeSantis invites it. Ron DeSantis wants the attention. Ron DeSantis wants to take on the federal government. Ron DeSantis wants to go in court because, you know, the courts have been packed by, you know, the Trump judges. Ron DeSantis doesn't see this as an issue. He sees it as an opportunity, everyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
If this hurts students, if this hurts the university, again, I'm looking at an AP article from the end of January, beginning of February. DeSantis pushes ban on diversity programs in state colleges. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has announced plans to block state colleges from having programs on diversity, equity, inclusion, and critical race theory. So again, I mean, these are shocking, and they go farther than anything when you think of diversity as black and white. You mentioned it's going to be, you know, students with, you know, veterans, it's going to be people with disabilities. It is so many people that are going to be negatively impacted with that, but that isn't the problem. He doesn't care about that. What he cares about is the headline and the opportunity to take on, frankly, the federal government.
Well, we've seen that in a lot of other instances with him. I'm sure people are familiar with when he had the migrants from Texas flown to Martha's Vineyard and dropped in the middle of Martha's Vineyard with no support system. I mean, he's a smart guy. He's being very strategic, and he is build up to a presidential run. And he is very good at capturing the headlines. I doubt there's anyone in the U.S. who hasn't heard something about what he's doing down here. I just hope that people around the country are paying attention, because down here in Florida, those of us who aren't part of sort of the group that totally supports what he's doing are very frightened. It's gotten to a very frightening stage with discrimination against LGBTQ students, book banning. There, right as I'm talking to you right now, there is a discussion happening at the Sarasota school boards because a parent is pursuing a book ban that has already been turned down at the school level and at the district level, and she's still pursuing it to the next level.
Carrie, let me just share something with you. So I was talking to a friend in Iowa, because I do cover presidential politics. Iowa was always the first caucus and New Hampshire was the first primary until recently. And but that is still actually true with the GOP, everyone. I just want everyone to know that while everyone is focusing on what's going to happen with the Democrats, first of all, probably it will be Joe Biden running again. So yawn, yawn, yawn. But on the Republican side, it's not going to be a yawn. It's going to be like the Wild West. So as I was talking to my contacts in Iowa, one of my friends said, you need to see what's happening in Iowa. So understand that when DeSantis does something and you and I read about it or get the headline, a couple of things happen. It doesn't stop in Florida. It gets then passed on to Governor Abbott. They actually call Governor Abbott in Texas Little DeSantis, because DeSantis does something and then Governor Abbott does it. Well, let me just show
DeSantis. DeSantis is pretty little.
Yeah, well, they're calling Governor Abbott Little DeSantis. Anyway, but then here's the story that just came out of Iowa, just like 24 hours ago. So as I was telling her about Ron DeSantis and telling her about what's happening with New College and telling her, we know about the book banning, the anti-woke stuff, all that other stuff. She said, Arnie, let me tell you what the Republican governor of Iowa just did. She just issued a statement that if one school district bans one book, then every school district in the state must ban the same book. So again, you were talking about Sarasota, what's happening with this book banning. Well, that, you know, you would think, well, that'll just be Sarasota. No.
Actually, it's already being proposed here that if it's booked and banned in one place, it should be banned throughout the state.
Right. So they're cloning. All right. It doesn't just happen in one location. It happens everywhere. So as she was telling me the story about what Governor Reynolds is doing in Iowa with this one state, you know, one book ban, then they all ban it. She also then went on to say she's grooming herself to be looked at as the possible VP pick for Ron DeSantis. So I just want people to understand these are not stories in isolation. The idea of taking on the federal government is exactly what Ron DeSantis wants to do. It's what Governor Reynolds wants to do. The idea of book banning shouldn't be about what local school boards want. It's now going to go statewide. Destroying New College isn't just about New College. It's going to go across the board. And as you point out, and I only have a minute left, is that what's happening at the university level has already been happening like crazy in the public education K-12 level. So this is really thematic. When it comes to education, they want to make education basically as they define education, not as education should in fact be defined. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I mentioned to you that sitting through this board meeting was very similar to sitting through the board meeting last fall after three DeSantis endorsed school board candidates. Remember, it's supposed to be a nonpartisan election. But three of our candidates were endorsed by DeSantis. They won. They have a conservative majority on the board. And the first thing they did at the first meeting was fire the superintendent, who had just earned a highly excellent rating. So this was like deja vu all over again for us down here.
We need to provide the split screen. And someone said to me, Arnie, you've got to talk to an educator in Florida, because, you know, Ron DeSantis is not as infallible as he is creating the impression. The media is doing it. He's doing things to an extreme. And again, he won by 20 points. So people are feeling that sense of infallibility. And yet he said there are weaknesses there. So, Carrie, I'm going to just ask you to end this way. If Carrie Seidman had to say there was a weakness in Ron DeSantis, what is it?
Oh, my gosh.
I'm serious. I mean, I know he's not a great talker. I know he doesn't really like people. I understand that. But you know what? Donald Trump didn't like people either, but he figured that out. He was a good talker, but kind of sort of. And Joe Biden's not such a great talker either. So I'm just trying to figure out if that's the only weakness, that's not much of a weakness. Is there something else that would really harm Ron DeSantis in his national run?
Overambition.
Overambition.
I don't know. You know, he's obviously going for it on this. And I'm kind of here in Florida where it's very present to us every day. I don't know how the rest of the country is absorbing this. I don't know. He has a lot of support here in Florida. He has a ton of support here in Florida, not in my city. Sarasota is kind of a tiny little pocket of blue, but Sarasota County is very red. And most of the state is very red, all of Central Florida, Northern Florida. So, you know, here his efforts are going over quite well. All of us down here are really hopeful that throughout the rest of the country, they see some of these actions for what they are, which is not necessarily the noble causes that he claims them to be, but rather basically political aspiration and ambition.
Well, he's using Florida as his tool and his weapon. And the fact that so many Floridians basically still embrace that is what's so frightening. And again, I keep thinking this is the state that, you know, re-enfranchised ex-felons only in 2018 with 60% of the vote. That today could never pass because Ron DeSantis would ensure that it would not.
Well, he's already ensured that they can't actually vote.
That's a whole other story. Carrie Seidman is an op-ed writer for the Sarasota Herald Tribune. The piece that she wrote was "Inside the New College Boardroom: An Ungodly Display of Power and Arrogance." Thank you so much for doing this, and I'm glad you're writing at least once a week because we may be calling you once a month. Take care. Thank you again. Ciao.
Thank you, Arnie.